This is a podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. As well as being Australia's best-selling female author, Monica McInerney is also the Overnights program's Dublin correspondent. So what a pleasure it was to catch up with her on one of her visits to Australia. She's right in the middle of writing her 13th novel, and her 12 books prior to that one are mostly multi-generational stories about home, love, loss, and family. It was a pleasure to welcome Monica McInerney back to the Overnights program.
Hello, Rod. It's lovely to be in the same hemisphere for once with you.
Indeed. Now, you usually come back because you've got a book to promote, but in fact, you've kind of got 12 books to promote this time.
I have. I'm kind of like, what Baker's Dozen's 13, isn't it? So I'm writing my 13th book at the moment, but I'm back here because the paperback of The Trip of a Lifetime, my last book, has just been released, and to coincide, my publishers Penguin have rejacketed in beautiful vintage floral fabric all 12 of my earlier books. So I'm doing a one-week book tour and seeing all 12 in bookshops and on display, which is really comforting because I'm at the tricky stage of writing the 13th when, you think, oh, no, can I get there? Can I get over the finishing line? So seeing all 12 of them is reminding me that I've done it before and I can do it again.
You know, speaking of books, your books on bookshelves, I saw one recently on Home and Away. Somebody, a really nasty character who I think subsequently has been murdered, her bookshelf had one of your books on it, Monica.
That is so fantastic. I wonder if I can get a screenshot of it or something. Because I got an email from a reader a couple of years ago, and I think it was either Home and Away or Neighbours, but there was a haunted, like a possible ghost plotline in a house, and it was like a poltergeist, and out of the blue, books were flying around the room, and one of them was one of my books flying across the room. So I thought, well, I don't know, is it good if a ghost throws your book across the room?
I'll say this also, where I don't see your books is at op shops. People buy your books and keep them. They do not give them away.
Well, they do, actually. And I'll tell you who did is my beloved mum, Mary. About 5 years ago, she was moving house here in Adelaide, and she packed up loads of books. And over the years, the 20 years that I've been published, each time I would get an early proof copy or a special edition or, the first edition, I'd sign it to her and, messing around, like joking, like really, really elaborate. Oh, dearest mum, I adore you so much. Thank you for everything. And they got more and more flowery, to amuse her and me. And so she had a whole collection of these first editions of mine, to Mum, Love, Monica. And anyway, so she packed up her bookcases, and she had, Mum's a big, big reader, and so she had loads of books. And then so she put all of my books that I'd signed and sent to her from Ireland in one box. And then she had six other boxes of books that she was going to send to a charity shop. And you might be able to guess what happened next. The wrong box went. And so she moved into the new house and went to unpack and couldn't find mine anywhere. And she didn't want to take all the books to one charity shop, so she dropped them in charity shops all around Adelaide. And we've never been able to get them back. We don't know. So they're obviously, went to one charity shop and got distributed or whatever. But it's actually, what can we do? We put out a public plea, but they were never found. But we're kind of amused that, somebody picks up this book and it's to Mum, I love you so much. Thank you for all the support for Monica. And she obviously gave it away.
Unbelievable. It could be a bit of a ploy by publishers. You put one copy in an op shop, and then people will want to read more of your books.
Well, they might. I love if people find books anywhere, in doctors' waiting rooms, in holiday homes, in libraries, I want people to, read not just my books, everybody's books. But I know, Melbourne and Sydney and Adelaide, I think Brisbane also, there's this terrific initiative called Books on the Rail, and it's two young Melbourne women, and they leave books deliberately on public transport. And it has a little sticker on it saying, this book is for you to read on the train, read it and then put it back on the train. So they're promoting reading by leaving them on trains and trams, which I think is a great idea.
You write so much about families. You create these families in your novels. Your own family, do they ask to be in your books, or do they ask to be kept out of your books, or do they say, oh, well, I know where you got that story from or that line from?
You wonder why I live on the other side of the world, Rod? I mean, I think in the early days with the first few books, they were a bit, you know, obviously a bit nervous that I was going to, you know, start, you know, basically recreating our family life through fictional families. But they've all relaxed and, you know, they enjoy it. I mean, obviously, the way I like to say it is I don't write factually autobiographical books. My books are emotionally autobiographical. So I draw on all the emotions I've felt as growing up in my big family, you know, the sorrows as well as the joys, as well as the, you know, great funny times and tense times. But I can't use them because I wouldn't be able to control them. They're uncontrollable in real life. And so I wouldn't be able to, you know, take bits of their personalities because they would start behaving as themselves in my mind and on the page and not as the fictional characters that I need them to be.
But you're an inveterate eavesdropper.
I'm shocking.
So when someone says something,
yeah,
do you write it down? Does that then find its way into the book deliberately where you think, right, I've got to create a scene where I can put that line in because I love that line so much?
It definitely does, actually. I shouldn't admit that. People would be nervous sort of talking around me. But no, it does. Sometimes, I mean, I describe writers as walking compost bins in that, you know, everything that we hear and see and experience, you know, goes inside us and mulches away and becomes the ingredients from which our books are produced. And certainly overheard conversations come under that. And for me, it's not often, sometimes it's not just the situation that I might borrow, but it might be very much the way somebody speaks. You know, perhaps they're very, you know, they gesticulate a lot or they lean in a lot or they're cross or, so I'll borrow traits of the way that they talk as much as the actual words that they're using. So, you know, and that's very, very helpful because otherwise, you know, every character in my book would behave like, yes, I would. And they can't because, you know, I'm writing about young families. I'm writing about older, you know, men and women. So the eavesdropping's brilliant help for that. To mannerisms, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
So, can you just make it up though, or do you always, if you have a character in your mind, think, right, I'm not basing it on this person, but I have the face of somebody in my mind and the way they talk?
I do. For example, in The Trip of a Lifetime, which is my most recent book, and that's about one of my favourite characters, an 85-year-old Irish woman called Lola Quinlan. And she emigrated to Australia when she was 20. And I've written about her in The Alphabet Sisters and in Lola's Secret, the follow-up. And the third book, Trip of a Lifetime, I have her going back to Ireland for the first time in 65 years. And so it's, you know, it's very much an emotional and difficult homecoming for her. And she goes back with her granddaughter and great-granddaughter, and to make things easy, they hire a driver to take them around, yeah, so that they don't have to worry about, you know, maps and what have you. And I had that character and I wasn't quite sure what sort of fella that driver would be. He was obviously going to be an Irishman. And one night in Dublin, I was catching a taxi from my house to another part of Dublin to meet friends for dinner. I was going to a place called Stony Batter, which is this real kind of hipster suburb where there's lots of restaurants. And I got in the taxi driver with him and you didn't expect to talk about politics or sport or the weather. And instead, he said, you know, where are you going? I said, Stony Batter, thanks. And he said, oh, the food there is incredible. And from the moment I got in until I got out, he told me all the restaurants he goes to, talked in great detail. Now, on page two of the menu on that one, I would really recommend, you know, the one with the sprinkled artichoke hearts or, you know, just the turmeric this, and, you know, really detailed gourmet. And he talked about how much he loves to cook. And it really amused me because you just don't expect, you know, a foodie taxi driver. And I thought, that was just brilliant. I got out and before I went in to see my friends, I took out the notebook I always carry and took all the notes of what he had said about the food. And Des, the driver in, yeah, The Trip of a Lifetime, is absolutely that taxi driver. He's really nosy and just talks all the time, but he just talks about food. He loves his food. And I would never have thought to have, you know, had a foodie driver, but for that taxi trip that night.
Monica McInerney is our guest, best-selling author. Does that taxi driver know? Would he read that book and think, wow, that's me? Or, given that there are a lot of cab drivers around, have you ever encountered him again?
No, I haven't, because I think he'd be very distinctive. I think he probably just, you know, he's like Meals on Wheels, the way, you know, he drives around. He probably talks to everybody. I'd love to, and if I did, I would tell him that, you know, that was the case. But perhaps if he did read it, he would probably think, oh, look, there's somebody else like me, you know, rather than think that is me.
Isn't that amazing? Has anyone ever said to you, that is me and I didn't like what you said about me?
Yes, actually quite often, surprisingly. Not, as I said, you asked about my family and not them, but a couple of times people have said, oh, that's me in the book, isn't it? And it genuinely hasn't been. And then I've read it back a few years later and thought, I can see why you thought it was, but, you know, and I think, oh, maybe it was, and I didn't realise at the time because, you know, I'm drawing on everybody I meet, really. A couple of times people have assumed it is them, and I've said it, it's not. And most of the time I'm not lying.
Can you convince them, though, that it's not?
I change the subject. I start talking about food instead.
Ooh. What about your husband?
Is he in my books?
Does he say things that then get put in the book?
Yeah, very much. And in fact, my sister, for my 50th birthday, my family threw me this really incredible birthday weekend, and it was a concert. Like, all the members of my family put on, we hired the RSL Hall down in coastal South Australia, and we came over from Dublin for it, John and I, and my family threw this most amazing, it was like being my own funeral. It was so beautiful. But they all did skits, and they all did songs, and they all did performances, and my sister, Maura, went through all of my books and took out all the descriptions of, you know, the males, if there's any romantic interest in the book. And she took them all out and she read them all on camera in this really deadpan voice and kept flashing up photographs of my husband, because basically all of my romantic heroes look exactly like my husband.
Wonderful, said.
And I hadn't realised, because my husband's very, you know, tall and lean, and he wears, he's very, very tanned, and he wears, you know, white shirts a lot, rolled up over his, you know, over his elbows, and black jeans, this kind of thing. And I realised just about all of my fellas in my books look exactly like John. Wow. But it was quite funny that just to have, you know, Maura reading them in this very deadpan voice, and here's another one from this book and here's another one from that book. So from now on, you know, I'm going to make sure all my romantic heroes are, you know, like, I don't know, 5 foot tall with bright red curly hair or something.
So, taxi drivers, perhaps.
Yeah.
You've written, obviously, 12 books. You're working on your 13th. Do you still have an editor who reads what you've written and said, right, this needs to be changed, or you need to emphasise this, or, you know, soft pedal that or whatever? What is the role of the editor for someone who's obviously as experienced and best-selling as you?
You cannot do without an editor. I have three. I do 10 drafts of each of my books myself before I show anybody else. So I'm my own harshest, most frightening editor in the first instance, because I don't plan my books beforehand. I literally make them up as I go along, because I love to see which way the story might go in unexpected directions. And that, for me, that makes it quite magical, because I get taken by surprise by what characters do or which direction the plot goes in. But what that also means is that at the end of each draft, there might be extraneous material that, okay, now that I've gone in this direction, I don't need that scene. So I'm my first editor. Then I show John, my husband, and Maura, my sister, who's a really talented editor in her own right. And they're my first readers, very different, very tough, but very honest. And so I really appreciate their early feedback. And then it goes to my agent, and then to my editor in Melbourne, and my editor in London, and editor in New York. So I have three different professional, wow, you know, publishing editors look at it. Everybody wants the best book possible, so you have to always remind yourself that, you know, they're all telling you these things or suggesting these things for the best reason, that they think that will make it the very best story it can be. So it's difficult at first, because I've obviously been through all drafts, and you think, oh, you know, I don't know if there's any more in me to, you know, can I make it or can I change it again? But once you've taken those editorial comments on board, it always results in a better book. So I love the process, actually. And if I teach a few writing courses in Ireland these days, and obviously, you know, hear from writers asking for advice, and I always say, you know, your first draft is just the beginning. You've got lots of drafts, and, you know, edit, and that's such a valuable part of the writing process.
When you send off that manuscript to three different editors, do they come back with the same conclusions? How do you know who's right and who's wrong?
No, that was quite tough. That I mean, it's a happy problem to have an editor in New York and in London and in Australia. So, you know, I never think, oh, poor me, you know, having to deal with all these different comments. But everyone that reads a book, Rod, you know, everybody takes something different from every book, every published book that you read. And in that same way, every editor reads a book different. And one of my books actually was Hello from the Gillespies a few books ago. And my editor in London was a young woman in her late 20s. And my editor in America was an older woman. I think she was 16, about to retire. And my editor in Australia, who I've been with for all my books, the very wonderful Ali Watts from Penguin. And she is, early 40s or so. And so really different women at different stages of their lives in different countries with different life experiences. And they all brought their own personality to the way they responded to that manuscript. And that was quite not confronting, but confusing for me initially, because they were all saying different things. Like, one of them might say, "Oh, I could see every piece of landscape you described, and that was spot on the locations. Thanks so much for that." And another one felt, "I couldn't quite see where the books were set," and it was because some of them had been to Australia in the outback where that book was set, and others couldn't picture it. All so right. I needed, put a little bit more detail about that for someone who hasn't been there, and like a family relationship. One of them, two of them were mothers. One of them wasn't a mother, so they felt different things about some of the mother child relationships that were in it. So it's very helpful. But at the end of the day, I literally would sit at home with all three sets of their editorial comments and go through a manuscript and mark them in three different coloured pens to see, here's what they think. And then I rest it for a couple of weeks and then go back and think, where's my story in the middle of this? And somewhere between them all. Otherwise, you'd be writing by committee. I can't do what everybody wants because it still has to be my story. But as long as you remind yourself, which I, do and try to do, that everybody wants, this to be the richest, most detailed book that you can make, that helps with that process.
Rich and detailed is a good way of describing your books, but everyone reads the book differently. You've got millions of readers. They don't all read the book the same way, so it makes sense, of course, that all your editors are reading them differently as well.
Exactly, yeah, that's what I think.
Rich and Detailed describes the novels of Monica McInerney. I cannot believe that you don't know where it's going when you start writing it. Now, you start with an opening line, mm-hmm. and then you work your way to that closing line,
yeah,
but you must at least have some sort of idea. Do you draw a family tree? Because they are detailed, intricate novels.
I don't draw a tree specifically. I have a really good memory, and so I have it. Most of it stays in my head. I have a lot of small notes, like not post-it notes, but I have the little square. Those little blocks of paper that you can get. And I, by the end of every book, I would probably have a couple of hundred of those that I've written down notes. As I'm writing, I think I know what's going to happen to that character. So I'll make a note on one of those, and then the next day when I come up to do my next lot of writing, that will trigger me to do the next, that day's writing. So they're all in my head, but I do a lot of thinking about my family, because each of my books start with a fictional family, and I work out, I'm like a casting director with a film. I work out, there's the mother, or sometimes there's no father, or there's no mother, or whatever the situation is. How many kids? Are they full brothers and sisters, or are they stepsisters, half sisters? So I make up what the family is, and I've always got my idea of for what I call an emotional explosion that I'm going to throw in, lob into the middle of that family to see how they all react and to see what direction that sends them spinning in. So that's always I know that before it starts, but I never know where that plot is going to go as a result of that explosion that I've set off. And I wouldn't write them right, I reckon, if it was all plotted out. I wouldn't feel like I needed to climb the stairs to my attic, because I know what's going to happen. It's going up every morning and thinking, what are they going to get up to today? Makes it like, as I've kind of said before to somebody, that it's writing a book is like reading a book, in that you turn the pages and don't know, where what's going to happen. But the catch is you have to actually write it to
read
it.
But I was just about to say as well that if you know where it's going, then your readers are probably going to know where it's going. Yeah. And you want to surprise them as much as surprise yourself.
That's it, exactly. I think so too. And I've often described the reading and writing relationship. It's like this beautiful kind of ESP, that something I've conjured up in my imagination, characters, settings, plots and sorrows, but also fun times, all of those things. I feel all those emotions very strongly when I'm writing. And when a reader picks up one of my books and they turn those words on the page back into all of those feelings in their own minds and imaginations. And I really believe that whatever I feel when I'm writing a scene, like I did a big event here in Marion in Adelaide last night to about 300 people, and it was I loved every minute of it, and they were beautiful. And afterwards I was talking to lots of the readers as I was signing their books, and the lady came up to me and said, "Oh, this, I just want to say to you, this particular scene that you wrote in The Trip of a Lifetime," she said, "I cried and I cried when I read that." And I said, "Well, as I was writing it, I was crying and crying too." And I often think that whatever I feel when I'm writing something, so if I'm taken by surprise, or if you know a plot suddenly goes spinning around the corner like on a fairground ride, the way I feel is how the reader feels.
So how are you as a reader? Do you avoid books like the ones you write because you don't want to be influenced by them, or you don't want to be accused of taking a story from somewhere else?
It depends in what stage of the writing process I am. I'm coming into the finish line with my 13th novel, so I'm probably over the next couple of months when I get back home and really just lock myself away to finish it, I won't read very much because there's only room in my head for for my own story for that time, because I really, it just takes over my mind, so I need to be just concentrating on my own. But over the last year, I've made a vow this year to be less online and read more. And so I'm back reading about two, sometimes three books a week, which I'm thrilled about. And every book I read helps me to know more about myself as a writer and to be a better writer, I hope, because I've been currently on a binge of Anne Tyler, actually, the wonderful American writer. So I've been rereading all of hers, because she writes about families and communities. And one day when I grow up, I'd love to be able to write as beautifully as she can, in the way that she can just say things so concisely and so quick with her character descriptions, a couple of lines. And so I read her for the joy of her storytelling, but also somebody sitting at the floor of a master, really. But I also read loads of crime books and YA books and poetry and everything, for the joy of storytelling, to remind me, this is what it's about. Keep the pages turning, and sometimes you notice also, if I'm not captivated by a book, I think, why isn't this working for me? And I might try and avoid what I've realised is the problem in my own writing. So for me, it's like constant, constant writing courses. That's what the books are, as well as entertainment.
What happens when Oprah recommends one of your books?
Well, she hasn't personally. I got recommended by her her magazine in America, and her website, oprah.com, and they did this a big feature for five must read holiday reads, or a title like that, and that was Hello from the Gillespies, and it was brilliant. I certainly felt like a lot of American readers got in touch, that they'd noticed it on her magazine. The world of book recommendations moves so fast, so quickly, that people are getting ideas for what to read all over the place. But that was, I certainly noticed, I got lots more notes and messages from American readers after that, which was really great.
More sales?
Well, not that I noticed. I didn't fly over in my Learjet, Rod, but I'll let you know when I have one.
This was, speaking of Learjets, three books to take on a plane flight, and yours was one of them. I mean, that's a pretty big recommendation, though.
Yeah.
It may not have been from Oprah, but she oversees everything that goes on in her magazine.
Yeah, no, it was a real surprise, actually, and I just got this very excited note from the publicity department in my American publisher. It's trying to be laid back about it, and I wasn't at all. I was squealing, obviously, when I heard it a few years ago.
How do you end a book, a novel? How do you determine that line is going to be the last one?
I do, in terms of the feeling, the mood, and I can spend sometimes 2 weeks on the last paragraph. I did with The Trip of a Lifetime. I worked it and worked it and worked it to make sure, because for me, I don't believe in happy endings because they're not realistic enough, but I'm an optimistic person. While also being realistic. So my longing for each of my books is to end on a hopeful note, because everything I do as a writer is because I'm a reader. And I love when I've read a book and I've been on this, big ups and downs and this journey with all the characters. And I like to be able to put the book down and feel they're going to be okay. Boy, they've been through the wars, but that family or that character is going to feel feel that there's, you know, there's hope ahead. So I don't write happy endings, I write hopeful endings. I hear the words almost like a piece of music. So when I finish writing the book after 2 years of writing it, for me it's like it's this big orchestral piece. And so there's been lighter moments and, you know, lighter instruments, and then bass notes and faster notes and slow, deep, you know, sorrowful moments. And for me, I hear that last chapter particularly as music in my head. And so when I'm doing my last read through, literally for me it has to end on the right note, and that's when I know I've finished.
You write so much about home. When you're in Australia, do you get homesick for Ireland?
I do. Not at the moment, actually, because Ireland's having a heat wave and I don't like the heat. So I'm thrilled to be here at winter time. And my husband's sending through like daily photos of our lovely, you know, little city garden. He's a great gardener, shriveling in the heat. And the grass is dry, like the grass is dead. And Ireland looks so different now because, you know, there's drought conditions and there are hose bans and water shortages. But I was thinking about this when I landed here back in Australia for this trip, and as I landed at Adelaide Airport, I thought, I'm home. But when I land back in Dublin at the end of the month, I know I'll go, I'm home. You know, I'm torn between two homes, I think, but so lucky that I can move back and forth between them both so easily.
And they both provide such rich material for your novels.
They do. I'm so lucky. I'm really, you know, to be able to draw on both of those locations and feel that I know them both intimately, that I do feel confident enough that, you know, that whatever setting I use, whatever location I'm using, it is as true to what those places are like as possibly can be.
For those people who think they know what your books are about and don't want to read them, what would you say?
I say, well, that's fair enough. I can't force anybody to read them. What a great question. What would I say to them? I would say, I hope if they don't read my books that they read somebody else's books that they at least are reading. You know, somebody might say, oh, you know, I don't like to read, so I'm sorry I haven't read any of your books. And I just, you know, I would implore them to read something, not just to keep writing and not just to keep the publishing industry afloat, but because reading is what human beings need to do. It's so important to all of us, for comfort, for entertainment, for, you know, the soothing qualities of reading. There's a study was done that shows that readers have more empathy because every time you read, you literally step into somebody else's mind and shoes and see how other people live their lives. And that's why readers are always great company, because they're open to the world, they're open to other experiences. So, you know, certainly if it's, you know, as long as people were reading something, I don't mind even if it's one of those Lady Bird books, anything. But I really always just want people to be reading.
You know, until we started speaking, when you're in Ireland, I'm here in Australia, I hadn't read any of your books because I don't know whether it occurred to me to read them. I've read all of them now and I love them. They are such joys to read. So people, if they haven't read one of your books, should maybe start at the beginning or just pick up one at random and enjoy it. Monica, it's always a pleasure talking to you, whether it be here or over there. And thank you so, so much for being part of the program.
Thanks so much, Rod, not just for reading my books, but also for talking to me. And I love our chats from Ireland to Australia too. So thanks a million.
And that's Australia's best-selling female author, Monica McInerney. And that was another podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. Thanks for listening.